Hello, everybody. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast in the unceded ancestral territories of the Squamish, the Musqueam, the Tsleil-Waututh, and the Kwai-Kwetlem. Today, you are listening to Speak Up at 10 a.m., and it is the first day of our Pride programming, which is so, so exciting. And the first feature that we have is Marv. So I interviewed Marv a few days ago, and Marv is a Black queer femme artist and community organizer based in Canada. They're the founder of Unity Art Collective, a space for BIPOC, queer, and trans folks to share their work. They're currently a full-time musical production and sound engineering student. So if you want to continue listening to this interview, we are going to speak about the stigma around pursuing a career in art in a capitalist society, Marv's experience being Black in the Vancouver art scene, their most recent album entitled Restless, and much more. From August 3rd to 9th, CJSF will be celebrating Pride Week. Do you identify within the LGBTQIA2S+ community? Do you create visual or literary art? This can be painting, drawing, photography, poetry, etc. Then consider submitting an original piece to us through Instagram DM at CJSF Radio by August 3rd to be featured on our story. In your message, make sure to include your art piece as well as a short blurb about what Pride means to you. We will be posting at least one art submission for each day of Pride Week. Stay tuned! Hi, Marv. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I've been busy just like doing a lot of, I don't want to even call it activism because activism is a white word. So I don't really like referring to myself as an activist, but I've just been doing a lot of work for my own community and the communities that I come from. And yeah, so it's been pretty exhausting, but it's like, we need to continue this work, and I've been learning a lot from doing this work, so I'm okay, but I'm definitely, like, tired because there's just been a lot of stuff going on. This trans woman I know, they live above me, got arrested yesterday, and I was present, and then I reached out to a group that I knew that does action, so they put something together very urgent, so I was there all night until this morning. So I'm like very beat, but that's okay. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure like witnessing things like that would be exhausting.
Yeah.
So can you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
So my name's Marv. I'm a young Black queer femme multidisciplinary artist based in Canada. I do a lot of community organization for communities to come together and discuss better options and in order for us to defund and abolish the police. And then outside of that, I'm a music student at RAC. I'm going to school for musical production and sound. And then I also do obviously a lot of artwork. I own Unity Art Collective, which is a space for BIPOC, queer, and trans folks to come together and share their work.
So, like, diving off into the deep end, I wanted to ask, in a capitalist society, making art is seen like it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Unless you sort of garner like huge amounts of money and fame and success. Mm-hmm. When did you start making art and what pushed you to build your career around it?
I think that's a very good question. It's funny, like, I was in the mirror today, and I was talking about how I'm anti-capitalist to myself. I think for me, it's like, I've always had a difficult time getting work, but it's like, I've been working since I was very young, but it's also like, it would be difficult for me to get work in order to support myself because I did not have that support when I was very young. So artwork for me kind of started as something to kind of escape the environment that I was in, and not that the environment that I was in was that horrible, but it's like, I'm someone who comes from a lot of poverty and a lot of generational trauma, and artwork has kind of given me the means to, like, A, make work that deals with that stuff and address it in my work, and then B, also just have somewhere else to go instead of always focusing my energy there. I think the older I got, things kind of just worked themselves out. And it literally wasn't until these last 6 months that I really, like, woke up and was like, oh my God, like, I have not had a job for a year and I've been fine. Like, I've been living off of my artwork, because for so long I felt like that is what I wanted to do. That is what I want. Like, I didn't want to work anymore. And it's like, I've been in a lot of spaces that were oppressive towards me as a Black queer person, a lot of workspaces that did not treat me like the way they were treating their other employees. My artwork has kind of given me the means to, like, be able to live and support myself, but also not have to be in spaces that are not for me and not for my people and do not represent who I am. Growing up, we are really told, if you go to school and if you get a good job, that is success. That is not true, because this system and this world is built on capitalism. And as an immigrant, I feel like we immigrant kids are taught to believe in capitalism a lot. And it's like, just me witnessing myself this past year, even though there's been a lot of hard stuff that's happened, it's beautiful how, like, anti-capitalism I've become. And, like, I don't work because I don't believe in labor. I don't think Black people should be doing labor. For as long as Black people are being killed and Black people are being imprisoned for no reason, I believe that Black people should not be doing free labor. So I don't work. I make artwork. I make artwork for my community, and I make artwork in order for me to live off of. It took me looking at Western society to really ask myself, why can I not be an artist, be successful, and, like, make just as much money as a white person does off of their artwork?
I think that that's a very brave thing to do, especially given the economic state, the economic circumstances of where we are.
Yeah. The way our generation's been able to know our rights as a constitution and as people of the world, and we've just been able to, like, come together as a community and build communities out of all of this. Totally. You know?
Mm-hmm. So I listened to your Restless project, and you re-released it on SoundCloud a few months ago. After the first few listens, I interpreted it as sort of like a coming of age record, especially the song's Corduroy and Changes. Do you feel like that's accurate? And was there an inspiration for your project?
That is definitely very much so right. I think Restless for me, I never really intended to, like, release the project. I was kind of, that was me kind of experimenting with music and sound to see what my sound was and what I wanted to do. And I think it ended up being Restless because, so Restless, the project itself, I think it's pretty much inspired by, like, a scenario of situations that had happened to me in the last 3 years that kind of built up to be, like, who I am. I make music that talks about death in a way where you wouldn't know it's talking about death. And that my grandmother passed away 2 years ago now when I went to see her. And I was the last person that she ever saw. So for me in my entire life now, there's always going to be this connection with that person. Because it's like we had such a moment that was so vulnerable. And it's like, even no matter how many times I explain it, it's like people will never get it. So me talking about it in my music was kind of that, but then it's like my mental health really deteriorated because of that situation. That was also power in itself, I felt like, because this person had so much knowledge and so much to tell me that they never got to tell me. For the last 2 years, I've really just been breaking down and thinking about this person's life and, like, where they've been, who they were. And my grandmother was a community organizer as well. She just never called herself that. And so really that's what Restless was about. And then it was just, it was pretty much a coming of age, but in a different way, because I feel like I've experienced being a young person in such a different way to my friends. Yeah, and I think I was just really talking about experiences that also happened to me regarding racism and anti-blackness that I faced. And like my music has always been kind of the only, one of the only tools that's helped me release emotions outside of me when these situations take place. Restless is honestly a story about a boy who is very tired and could not sleep. And it's really about like Black joy and Black death. And yeah.
At this point, our Zoom connection cuts out, which is just something you sort of have to deal with during COVID-19 times. While you wait, please enjoy Corduroy and Changes off of Marv's demo, Restless.
To my demons that told me that I was pretty, I told them I know. Grandma had to go, carry lonely up the aisle in a hole without a smile. Corduroy on corduroy, they took away my black joy. Getting closure is my cup of tea. My, who am I supposed to be? What's the point of life if you aren't even trying to grow? Lately I've been having trouble living in the mode. When I'm not doing good, I gotta let my niggas know. I really wanna leave, but I'm way too scared to go. All of us are kids, we say shit that we don't mean. All of us are kids, I would hate to see you bleed. You care too much about your self-esteem. You care too much about the craziest things.
So I was going to send you the references for the painting, your painting I was talking about, but I don't know the name of it. I can describe it to the best of my ability. It's the one with the blood like splattered on.
Oh, yes.
Is there a name for it at all?
I think it's an untitled. It's been okay. So long. I made that painting 2 years ago for an art show that I did.
Okay, I wanted to ask what this painting represents to you, and you can be as vague or as detailed as you feel comfortable with.
Yeah. So basically, so that painting for me, it was kind of the killing of an old version of myself. And it was kind of, so the painting to me was about whiteness and white people pushed me to a point. And that is kind of why the painting is so aggressive itself. It's definitely one of my most aggressive pieces, but to me, like, that piece of work was just kind of about, like, I felt like I'd reached a point of myself where I couldn't take any of it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The anti-blackness, the compromising of myself, the pretending, the pain. I made that painting after I got out of the psych ward.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this was in 2018. I got hospitalized for depression and some suicide stuff. Yeah, so after I got out, and during that time, the doctors and my friends thought it would be a good idea for me to kind of just paint a lot, because they thought that that would kind of help me release a lot of trauma and just like a lot of pain and whatever I was going through at the time. I did a lot of work during that time because I wasn't working really, and I wasn't doing much, or I wasn't allowed to do much. So I had a lot of downtime. And in that downtime, I was just doing a lot of painting. And it's like, it's not funny, but it's like when I was making a lot of that work, it's like I was not fully there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like when I look at that work now, it makes sense to me that that person made that work, because I'm not that person anymore. Like, I've also changed and I've grown, but I felt like my younger self died in the process of me going through like so much trauma and like just being hospitalized. Part of me just really died in order for me obviously to become somebody else. But it's also like there's pain with that. It's like there was just generational trauma that came with that. So I really just felt like that was me like stripping away something that I was taught to be my whole life that I no longer wanted to be. That was me kind of killing the shame of my existence. That was me just really changing, and also killing these like white supremacy and colonial ideas of blackness and my own blackness.
So I know that you split up your time between Vancouver and the East Coast. But do you feel that being black in a predominantly non-black art scene in Vancouver has affected the way you sort of experience or exist in certain spaces?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the Vancouver art scene still has a lot more work to do. My decision to departure had a lot to do with me feeling like the city itself had nothing to offer for the person I am right now. And I felt like I have a lot to offer the city. My existence in this city itself is something mm-hmm. that no white person can ever do, period. I'm someone who's had so many art shows, like, and has been a part of a lot of art show lineups, and I definitely did not feel supported by the Vancouver art scene. That's all I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically that group of people who've, you know, went to Emily Carr and like have been to New York and just all this stuff. It's like, I just did not feel supported by the Vancouver art community, because it's like none of them would kind of come to my things. And then when that's also the thing, it's like people would not, these people from these communities do not show up for me. And then when people would see me, they would kind of be like, oh, I love your work, I support you so much, I love you, and just kind of going off. And then, like, also people just making me do free labor of being, like, trying to talk to me about my trauma and being like, I really connected with this piece about this. And I'm just like, that piece is literally about my grandmother dying.
Right.
What the fuck do you know? What the fuck does your white ass know about Black Death? Like, mm-hmm. you know? Vancouver itself, like, obviously Vancouver, like, it's my home, and I'm always gonna come back to it no matter what. I just feel like, yeah, like, the Vancouver art scene just has a lot of growing to do still. And, like, you know, like, with that being said, like, I was also given so many opportunities by, like, people like Shanique, who runs Level Up, people from Newsy, my friend Betty and Zem, I was given opportunities there to kind of grow and make work about our experience as Black queer femme people who are trying to build a community and like build spaces and spaces where there is no space for us. But I do feel like a lot of my time in Vancouver and being a part of the Vancouver art scene, especially around white people and non-Black people, me being in those rooms, and I wrote a piece about this for my art collective Unity, I feel like often I'm invited into white spaces because I dress well and I talk well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like most people would say, I act like a white person, which I hear a lot. So really, like, whiteness likes me because I'm this thing to them that makes sense often, if not. So when whiteness welcomes me into spaces and art spaces, it is not to protect me. It is to take something away from me and then capitalize off of it. And that can be my mannerisms. That can be the way that I speak. That can be the way that I'm dressing. That can be a conversation that I'm having with white people, and they could go make it, write an essay about it for Emily Carr. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it sucks, but it's like, often as a Black person, and I'm sure like you can relate as a person of color, it's like, I'm often having to kind of choose what I tell white people now and what mm-hmm. I do not tell white people, and what I show white people and what I do not show white people. So yeah, to wrap it up, like, I feel like, yeah, like, the Vancouver art scene has a lot of work to do. And, like, you know, and not to discredit, like, there's so many amazing Black fucking people who are killing it, and BIPOC folks who are doing such good work. Like, mm-hmm. Paisley, she runs Damn. People who are doing shit like that. And, like, she's also been doing a lot of community organization, and she started this thing called Decolonize with her mother, who's... They're both two Indigenous women. So, you know, like, I think Vancouver is slowly growing in itself. And I think as I get older, I realize that I can't take any of that stuff personally, because it's also like a lot of the people that I had to grow up and be around were people who were raised on white supremacy, colonialism, and capitalistic ideas of living. So it is up to me now and my community, sadly, because it should be white people doing this work, but it's like, it's up to us to kind of undo, because if I don't undo, white people are not going to undo. And then when I'm no longer on this planet and a young gay Black artist wants to move to Toronto and make artwork, they won't be able to do that. And I don't want that to happen. What I would like to see more happening in the Vancouver arts community specifically is older people who have resources sharing their knowledge and sharing their resources with younger people who are trying to create things. Because so often that is not happening in Vancouver. I do not see that. As a young gay Black person, I would have older Black and white cis men coming up to me and claiming they supported me when they have money that they were sitting on that they could have given me in order to create work. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? So I think a lot of people in Vancouver also love to talk about community, but let's face it, there's really no community. So I think people need to do the work of actually trying to, you know, defund police, dismantle white supremacy, and actually create community. Because it's so small, too, to an extent where it's like, we all know who the people who should not be a part of that community are.
Yeah.
So why are we still letting them? Why are we still letting people who have caused harm upon Black BIPOC folks into these spaces? Why are we still granting them access into these spaces and to these people? And that was another thing that I also struggled with. And it's like, I think, you know, with art scenes, there's such a responsibility, not just Vancouver, but any art scene. It's like, it's usually like young people around older people. And it's like, you as older people. And, you know, like, I know that age, people say age doesn't matter, but age does matter.
Mm-hmm.
Even me at 21, when I'm around people who are 19 and 18, I have a responsibility to protect them and to listen to them. So I feel like in art scenes, older people have a responsibility to listen to younger people and to share their knowledge and share their resources instead of laughing at them, which I've experienced a lot. And, you know, a lot of people not believing that I could do the stuff that I have done, and yet here we are. So Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just about communities actually showing up instead of talking about showing up.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, that was my second question to you, how you feel like, you know, the Vancouver art scene could change in respect to anti-oppressive practices.
I think, yeah, it's just calling people in, making people accountable. As a, like, I did not feel seen in Vancouver. I did not see myself for most of my life. And I'm not trying to exaggerate it and sound like it was this horrible experience, but I'm an immigrant, you see. I moved here when I was very young to a place where I was most of my life the only black person. And my whole life I was taught to love whiteness instead of loving myself. And I was taught about white history instead of being taught about black history. So I think what Vancouver needs to do is create more space and give more space and hold space for black people and indigenous people, especially indigenous people and indigenous artists.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are all on their own land. Like, this is not my land. I'm a settler here. And at the end of my journey, I'm going to get to go back to my own land where I will only speak my language, where I will only see my people. I will interact with my people and lead my people something greater than what they already have now. But I think, yeah, in the meantime, like, I think what people need to do is stop the mediocrity, stop the performativeness, because it's a lot worse on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast. Because mm-hmm. here, like, East Coast, people don't fucking play. People right. call you out on that shit. So I think in Vancouver, white people just need to stop, like, drop that fake I'm here for you shit, because you are not, especially mm-hmm. in the art scene. Because it'd be the same people that show up to those parties that are not showing up or are not saying something when a traumatic event happens to a black person. So I think people just need to, like, gain more common sense and just show up for these communities. Acknowledge your power, acknowledge your presence, acknowledge yourself, and ask yourself, what are your intentions within this art scene? Acknowledge that you are taking up space on stolen land. Acknowledge that you are viewing someone's artwork. Because often when I've put on shows in the past, it's been amazing. It's always been amazing. But what I did find was some people would show up and, you know, wow, this work is so intense. Yeah, that's my experience. I'm black. I'm not going to paint fucking, I'm not going to do abstract art about how I had a mushroom trip at Wreck Beach. You know what I mean? Like, right. My experience is not that. Like, I'm fucking black. Like, I've been physically harmed by the police in Vancouver. A lot of traumatic events happened to me while I was in that city. And me making artwork about it has been the only way I've been able to process and let these things go. So I think it's just about white people being aware of their presence within black and indigenous, especially spaces. And that's where it starts.
Like you said before, you're one of the founders of the Unity Art Collective. Can you give us a bit of background into what it is and what informed your decision or your collective decision to launch it?
So Unity has been an idea of mine for the last 2 to 3 years. I was actually originally going to start an art collective with some friends, and it was going to be called Data Art Collective, and it was going to be for BIPOC people, and it was such a beautiful experience, but we never got to start it, and we would meet up a lot and have conversations around harm reduction, and what it was me, black and indigenous queer kids who are my age, and we met up a lot, and we would talk about our experiences with nightlife, harm reduction, and what not to do. And, like, it's so, like, again, and that's what I mean going back to how I'm so impressed by my generation. It's like, we are able to think about the police are the last people we want to call in an event of an incident that takes place that is harmful.
Mm-hmm.
We as a community will take it upon ourselves to resolve the incident ourselves before it gets out of hand. So I think, yeah, we were talking a lot about that, because events do happen in nightlife, and things can sometimes be triggering. Like, people are doing drugs, which is okay. Like, drugs are a part of life for some people. So we would always talk about stuff like that. But I think all of us were kind of not in the right space at the time to start something, so it never happened. And then 2 years later, I kind of took it upon myself to start Unity, because Just as a black artist, and like, you know, like, I am a black artist, things are slowly happening for me, but I'm still a struggling artist. I don't have the funding I have in order to make any of the projects that I want to make right now. So I think, yeah, like with Unity, I just started it because I not only wanted to feature my work, but I want to reach out to, and I want BIPOC folks to reach out to me and give me their work. I'll post it. I'll share it. I'll do everything I can to make sure your work gets seen, because I think more than ever right now, like, we BIPOC people are the voice for the world, because they're, especially black and indigenous people, period. Like, we are the voice of the world right now. Mm-hmm. And people need to hear us more than anything. And I started Unity because the world needs unity. Our communities need to unite. Unity is really just about community. It's about building communities for people who do not have communities, like myself. And I think the concept to me comes from, you know, originally where I'm from, where my ancestry comes from. I come from a small village. I'm African indigenous. And in that small village, there was never police. Mm. In that small village, we all gathered upon this tree whenever there was a problem, and we talked about it. We talked about it. We all gathered. And that's really what Unity was inspired of. It was inspired by my grandmother and my ancestors, and like my grandmother's community organization and her willingness to love. Really, that's really why I created Unity, because I love these people with all my heart. And like, these people's work, not only their work, but them as a person, they deserve to win. They deserve the world. So that is really why can't wait to see the work that I do with that.
Yeah, I'm so excited to see as well. Well, I saw that you recently hosted your first show, I think on July 1st, in the midst of the pandemic. So how, like, what were some of the unexpected challenges or like positive incomes that came from the whole experience?
So the show, actually, it was in this new space that like not a lot of people know about yet on Hastings. So obviously I had PPE and it was 35 capacity. So I kind of just, what I did for the show is I did not invite any white people, and I told white people they were not allowed to come. And the show was going to be for BIPOC folks only. So I kind of got BIPOC people to show up for free, and the show was to them for free. No one had to pay anything. And then I also featured it on Zoom, where people paid and like people donated money to see the show. And I think that's an advantage in itself, because people got to meet people they literally never would have met. And, you know, like my friends got to meet people that I also know that like, where it's like, oh my God, I've seen you before, but I never spoke to you type of thing. Because, you know, like, it's just like, we are all so divided, especially black people. So yeah, I think, yeah, that was kind of the advantage of it. Just like not having like white people there, and mm-hmm. like having literally one white person in the room, and just seeing these young, incredible BIPOC artists interacting with each other and just talking about things and just laughing and just hanging out and being together, especially during this fucking hard time. Yeah, it's just like, I was like, I brought masks, there was water, there was just like things. Definitely the disadvantage is just the pandemic in itself. I think it's really just affecting BIPOC people more than anyone, because a lot of us don't have regular jobs like myself. Like, I'm a community organizer and I do that free, like, willingly. Like, I'm not getting a check from showing up to actions and speaking mm-hmm. to the public. I'm not being cut a check for that. I'm showing up because I love these people. I love these people because these people are my community. I'm not, you know, like, I'm not being given money for Unity Collective. That's just mm-hmm. stuff that I'm doing because I love these people. Again, these people are my community. So I think, yeah, like, COVID's really affected us, and I think that's just the negative impact itself. But yeah, it was just very interesting, like, throwing a party in a pandemic, mm-hmm. because it's also like, I was so worried. I was like, oh my God, I hope no one gets anything. Like, oh my God, I'm like, everyone, here's a mask, right. Like, distance. But it was fine. Like, it was really fine. It was just like, people showed up, and people, like, obviously no one showed up who was sick. So, you know, like, people listened to. So it's just about cooperation at this point from the communities.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was like very interesting.
So is there anything else you want to touch on that I maybe didn't mention today?
I think if it's helpful, I would like to talk about academia within Vancouver and within the Western society in general, and just like growing up in schools as a Black person.
Mm-hmm.
I think more than ever right now, teachers have a responsibility because you're in power. So especially teachers who have students who are BIPOC, like, you have a responsibility to these fucking kids to actually teach them about their history, because it's like, you have that right, but you, and school systems, they have that right, but they're just refusing to educate kids about Blackness and Black history. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The school system and teachers themselves have a responsibility more than ever, not just with the pandemic, but with everything that has taken place, because it's like, what you teach to these kids and what you say to these kids is going to benefit, is going to affect our future and their future. So I think it's very important, because I remember when I immigrated here and I was put into the Canadian school system, a lot of the things that they taught me, I'm not using any of those things now. Those things are not coming in hand to me at all.
Mm.
School systems are built against us. I actually do not believe in school, period. Like, I think I would have been better off being homeschooled. I did not learn anything. And I remember an incident at the end of my high school. Also, on top of that, just facing so much racism and discrimination from white people who came from homes that believed in white supremacy ideals and colonial ideals and capitalistic ideals. And me being this poor Black kid going to school, coming from fucking poverty, and just being treated like I was nothing constantly, and literally having kids tell me, you're not going to go anywhere in life. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's like, school systems need to have better systems for these kids. Like, for me, everything I do is for kids, like, specifically. And it's like, you don't have to be young to be a kid. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has their inner child. Everything I do is for my inner child, to try and heal them from trauma that they experienced. But, yeah, I think, yeah, just like, and I remember an incident where, I don't know if you remember 4 years ago when I made that post, I'm sure you do, but about how people from my school were calling me things like whitewashed and like telling me that I was a nigger and just so many things.
Yeah.
And I remember like you were in the comments fighting with this one white girl who I was previously fucking friends with. Because you see, it's also like, there's no space for us. We have to be friends with people that harm us. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you were in the comments and I want to thank you for that. But it's like, it's just things like that. It's like, why is the school, like, why are schools not checking in with their students?
Mm-hmm.
Why are kids not being given better mental health resources? Like, I was depressed for the whole time I was in school, and no one did anything, and my teachers knew it, and the counselors knew it, but no one gave a shit. So schools, like, have a responsibility right now, and will forever have a responsibility if I'm on this planet. And I'm going to keep holding school systems, police systems, and any system that's, like, kind of fucking advertising capitalistic ideas and colonialism and white supremacy accountable, because the communities I come from, we don't believe in stuff like that. Like, that stuff is harmful to us. That's the stuff that kills us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, like, just school systems have a responsibility to do better. And I'm highly disappointed in school systems, not just in Canada, but in America as well, and in other places in the world. And yeah.
Yeah, that was a great addition. Thank you so much for speaking on that. I think
even,
you know, now talking about, and as BIPOC people, you know, talking about racism and experiencing it has been our lives. But yeah. only in the past few months have, you know, white people been, you know, talking about anti-racism and anti-oppressive yeah. practices and things like that. So I think it's really important to continue to highlight that even after, you know, the Instagram trend has dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think for me now, like with my life, I want to call out people who are in power. I want to call out people who are in power and ask them why they are running shit the way that they are running shit. And who taught them to run shit like that. You know what I mean? Because it's like, why are white men teaching our children about Christopher Columbus when Christopher Columbus has harmed so many indigenous people?
Right.
Why am I being taught about Napoleon? Why? I don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
I want to learn about Marsha P. Johnson. I want my children to know who Marsha P. Johnson was.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to say her name forever and ever. You know, I don't want them to learn about fucking world leaders who are white people, because those are the people that killed my people. And those are the people that installed generational trauma inside of my people and inside of indigenous people on their own land. So why are kids being taught about those people in school systems when those people are not here to help us?
Right, right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I also want to touch upon one more thing. So, just for the term BIPOC, it's Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like people of color need to be checked more.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to touch on that. I feel like people of color need to be checked more by white people and people of color when they're coming for Black people.
Totally.
The action that I went to yesterday was about an incident that happened between a person of color calling the police on a Black trans girl. And it's been very triggering for all of us involved. So,
mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, like, I think people of color need to be checked more.
For sure.
People of color need to be checked more by people of color and by white people. And, like, Black people should not be expected to keep doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah. Thank you for that addition. I think it's really important to, for, you know, people of color like myself to realize that, you know, conflating people of color and Black and Indigenous people, it's not the same thing.
Not the same. And right. A lot of people of color do not realize that. A lot of people of color think that their experience being a person of color and my experience being Black is the same thing, but it does not equate to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Blackness and people of colorness is not the same thing. And I think a lot of people of color need to realize that it is not the same thing,
mm-hmm.
period.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, the anti-Blackness that, you know, runs rampant, not only in North America, but also internationally, that's not something that, you know, we can brush under the rug and sort of, again, like, conflate
yeah.
ourselves with the Black experience, because it's not something we've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so, so much for interviewing with me on such short notice.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean, come on again whenever you want. Thank you so much for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This was our very first Pride feature of the week. And I'm so excited that it was Marv and we had an amazing conversation. And I hope you all enjoyed it. The next song I'm going to be playing is Marv's mix entitled Mix 3.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
Body. I don't even think I can comprehend right now. I can't even comprehend, like, the emotions that I'm, like, emotionally experiencing, that, like, they're physically affecting me instead of me emotionally experiencing them the way that I'm supposed to as a person. You know, like, at some point, you just kind of give up on yourself. And then you, like, realize, I can't do that. I need to just, like, keep going. And that's why, like, I'm trying to...
And then it's like, what do you do? Because
it's like, you're just seeing so much stuff. And it's like, as someone who's already experiencing darkness and, like, you know, like, is already trying to come out of... Especially black, queer, femme people... You can take all the pictures. It's just like it hits different. It really hits different. So many different types of black people. And in the future, I think that's also another thing, is that we as human people, we are not here. We are always in the future. So that's kind of like something that I'm also trying to do, is just really be here. She's a friend of mine, darling.
Monique, would you tell her? Oh, nothing. I just said it's hard, but it's hard to be hopeful sometimes because it's like,
yeah.
Sometimes it's like, it feels like there's nothing to be hopeful about black people. I don't know. I think I'm still trying to find. Taking the wrong way. Shit, she looks bad.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out the vid during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox and Four Fox without commercial interruption. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the shape of a war theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the dub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the court from 29th District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Beverly Hillbillies and Hooterville Jerks will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Hall, women's racist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. Song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not write jerks and make calls bad rep. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.